This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support this free service by September 5th and you could win a Mini Cooper S convertible. Go to KCRW.com for details.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
The Disorganization of American Labor. Hello again, I'm Marvin Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The AFL-CIO's 50th birthday celebration continues, minus 25% of its members and a big chunk of its budget. The Teamsters and Service Employees International Unions have created the biggest split in the labor movement since the Depression. On To the Point, organized labor is on the decline. Is this week's division about principle or personality and money? Can the dissenting unions restart the organized labor movement, or has it become irrelevant to the global economy? On Reporter's Notebook later on is the phrase, war on terrorism going out of style in the Bush administration. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warman Olney, back with To the Point. At this week's Chicago convention, the AFL-CIO is licking its wounds. Its two biggest unions are going their own way, and others may follow. On To the Point, has organized labor become irrelevant in the globalized economy, or is it more important than ever? On Reporter's Notebook, it's all in a name. Bush administration officials are changing the way they talk about the fight against Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups. First, this news update. Discovery has reached its orbit. It's the first space shuttle to fly since the Columbia disaster of 2003. Here's George Diller, the voice of Launch Control.
Six, five, three engines up and burning. Three, two, one. And liftoff of Space Shuttle Discovery, beginning America's new journey to the moon, Mars, and beyond.
Roger Launius is a former chief historian at NASA. He now chairs the Division of Space History at the Smithsonian's Air and Space Museum. Roger Launius, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Must be a relief to you and all others who are interested and concerned about space travel.
It was quite a relief when it reached, when they had the separation from the external tank and they were on their way to reaching orbit, you bet.
There apparently has been some report of debris falling off. We don't know exactly what that means. They say they're going to review it frame by frame. I assume that would be of a concern since we know what happened to the Columbia.
Well, absolutely. Everything's of concern, and they're going to pay special attention to whatever that might have been that people saw coming off. But it's really too early to speculate on any kind of issues associated with that. They're going to have to analyze that data.
If there were a problem, they're going to be docking with the space station. They have a long, as I understand it, 100-foot arm that can examine the heat shield for damage. So presumably, if there were a problem, a shuttle could go up and bring them back down?
Well, presumably, that's an option that they have been exploring the possibility of doing. It may also be possible that that they could repair that on orbit if it's a tile that came off or something like that. There is a plan underway to try to figure out how to replace tiles that might be lost on orbit, as well as doing things like having a rescue mission to go to the space station to pick them up.
Well, how important is this mission to what we just heard, that this is the beginning of a new journey to the moon, Mars, and beyond, as George Diller, the voice of Launch Control, put it?
Well, that was a very nice phrase from his perspective and from NASA's perspective as they launched. And what they're really trying to signal is the fact that we're returning the shuttle to flight at this point. They're going to fly the missions necessary to bring the International Space Station up to the specs that they wanted to try to achieve, and then somewhere in the 2010 arena, retire that shuttle, build a new exploration vehicle, what they're referring to as the Crew Exploration Vehicle, that will have capability not only go into Earth orbit, but ultimately to the moon. And so this is a step toward that process.
How old is the technology that's now being used on the shuttle?
Oh, the shuttle technology is 1970s. At best, there's been some upgrades since that time, but the vehicle was designed in the early 1970s, built in the late 1970s, and has been flying since 1981.
So what has to be done then to gear up for this new vehicle?
Well, there's a whole lot of things that are underway. They're right now in kind of definition of the project, trying to determine exactly what are the parameters that they have to achieve in terms of this new vehicle that they'd like to build. And they're trying to define those requirements so that they can get a firm sense of exactly, you know, what sort of propulsion system do they want, how many pounds of thrust, what kind of capabilities do they want with the orbiter, and so on and so forth. And all of that is preliminary to being able to actually put a price tag on it, which is going to be a key component.
You were on a program we had a couple of weeks ago when the shuttle was the previous launch was aborted, and there were people who were saying that they didn't think NASA had the resources at this point to both run the shuttle program up to 2010 as planned, and also develop the crew exploration vehicle. What do you think?
It's a tall order. There's no doubt about that. They're going to have to deal with this issue of operating the shuttle, which is an expensive proposition. But they need to do it to complete the station and at the same time try to gear up for the next new replacement vehicle that is going to follow shuttle. And how do you do that without cutting other programs, which they are prepared to do at some level, but not to the level perhaps that is going to be necessary to do both shuttle operations and shuttle replacement at the same time.
A lot of people are concerned about whether or not in the meantime they'll be able to repair the Hubble Space Telescope or to, retool it, whatever it is that's required. What do you think of the prospects for that?
Well, they're going to have to look at that. That's one of the early casualties of this process was a decision on the part of Sean O'Keefe, who is the predecessor of the current administrator at NASA, to say we're not going to fly that servicing mission that we had on the books for shuttle. And it created a furor in the scientific community because there's really very little doubt about it. The Hubble Space Telescope has been a stunning scientific instrument. And to continue it in operation as long as possible is something that's of great value to a lot of people. But how do you balance obtaining the necessary flight time and money necessary to operate a Hubble servicing mission and then service Hubble and obviously continue operations with this other requirement to go forward with the replacement? And it's been a challenge. It's still up in the air. There's some consideration that's still being given as to whether or not that's the right decision, and we may yet see the new NASA administrator come forward and say, we're going to fly that mission.
All right. Obviously, many debates about priorities to come. Meantime, Roger Lanius, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you.
Former chief historian at NASA, now at the Smithsonian Institution. In a moment, disorganization in American labor on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
We're only back with To the Point. Yesterday, the AFL-CIO consisted of 56 unions. Now there are 54. But between them, the two that left, the Teamsters and the Service Employees International, have taken away some 25% of the AFL-CIO's working members and a lot of its budget. Other unions may follow. This week's Chicago convention originally was intended to celebrate 50 years of a united labor movement. So what's the atmosphere there now? Harold Meyerson writes about labor for the American Prospect. He's also a columnist for the Washington Post, political editor and columnist for the LA Weekly. Harold Meyerson, I know you're at the convention. Thanks very much for joining us.
Always a pleasure, Warren.
What about the atmosphere on this second day after the breach of yesterday?
It's not as festive as had originally been planned when this was conceived of simply as a celebration of 50 years. The problem, of course, is the movement is a lot weaker than it was 50 years ago, and with those weaknesses have come some frustrations, some tensions, some divisions, and now some secessions with possibly more to follow. So there's a sense of the people remaining, of the folks who are being seceded from rather than the seceders themselves, of anger, of bitterness, of sorrow, a lot of second-guessing, why did this have to happen, the differences aren't that great, there are no real ideological or constituency differences here. So lots of questions, and the biggest one is where do we go from here and what happens now?
When you said that the movement is weaker than it was 50 years ago, is there a sense at the convention that it's weaker than it was the day before yesterday?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No, it's a sense of crisis. I mean, just to begin with, the AFL-CIO itself, obviously it's already made some major cuts in staff and programs. It's actually eliminated its international affairs division, but now it's going to have to do more. And the particular flashpoint right now, which is being addressed just actually within the last hour, is what happens to all the central labor councils and state federations. This is where the actual political work of American labor usually is conducted, the get-out-the-vote operations and such. There are a lot of central labor councils in a lot of cities where SEIU and the Teamsters are disproportionately a dominant force in the labor movements of those cities that are saying, wait a minute, it's one thing to pull out of the national organization, but it doesn't make any sense to pull out of our local councils. And here's where there's some tension in several different ways emerging. The original position of the AFL-CIO in its constitution says if you're not an affiliate of the national organization, you can't belong to central labor councils and state federations. Sometimes those have been ignored. President John Sweeney of the AFL-CIO had said going into the convention that he intended to enforce that so that if SEIU, for instance, left the national AFL-CIO, it would have to withdraw from, for instance, the Los Angeles County Federation of Labor, the Central Labor Council of New York and Chicago, et cetera. But you're getting lots of folks from the Central Labor Councils and the state federations saying this will be a crisis for us. And the unions that are withdrawing, both SEIU and the Teamsters yesterday, made clear they want to stay affiliated with the state federations and local councils. So just within the last 20 minutes, Secretary Treasurer of the AFL-CIO, Richard Trumka, told us in a press conference that actually no decision is going to be made on this here in Chicago. They will have a special meeting of their executive council in several weeks to discuss this conundrum about what to do with the state and local bodies of the AFL-CIO.
Harold Meyerson, again, a labor writer for several publications. We'll come back and talk with you further a little later on. Again, he's reporting from the Chicago Convention. Stephen Lerner is not at the convention. He's director of the Property Services Division of the Service Employees International Union, one of those that has pulled away from the AFL-CIO. Mr. Lerner, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Harold Meyerson said there is a sense of crisis now at the convention. Did you and the Teamsters and the other unions that are considered dissenters here create a crisis?
The crisis has been brewing and was created years ago when the crisis started hitting American workers. American workers, because unions haven't organized and are weaker, have been losing health care, have been losing pensions. You have to look no farther than the airline industry to see the crisis workers are facing. And so we think what needs to be addressed is the crisis workers are facing, and that we can make dramatic changes and need to make dramatic changes to help workers build the strength they need to make their lives better. So our issue isn't whether there's a crisis in Chicago at a convention. Our issue is a crisis for the millions of workers who can't pay their bills and don't have health insurance for their children.
What then would you say to, I know you are more interested in organizing new workers than you are in paying a lot of money for political campaigns, although we can get to that in a moment. But what will you say to new people, not at the moment part of the organized labor movement, in order to get them into it, about these dramatic changes that you're looking forward to?
Well, our union has grown by 900,000 people in over the last 10 years, and it's because we have a strategy of organizing whole industries at once and really making a difference in workers' lives by creating the kind of strength you need to take on giant global corporations. So we're going to say more of what we've been saying, which is workers can win despite the obstacles if we approach this correctly, and that there is a moment of hope and opportunity in this country and around the world where workers can say, if we put our resources into organizing, if we're willing to take the risk, if we focus our attention, that we can take on these companies and win the kind of things that workers need and demand now.
Has the AFL-CIO, under its current leadership, become, as some have phrased it, a satellite of the Democratic Party, too involved with one party?
Well, what I would say is that we can't depend on any political party. Workers can't depend on for their fortune, that we need to support candidates or parties that are going to support workers and their issues. And part of the problem now is the reason we're losing elections is not because people don't have a good political campaign. We fundamentally don't have enough members. The math isn't in our favor. The reason Kerry partly lost was because we couldn't win the state of Ohio. The way we'll start winning politically is by organizing hundreds of thousands of new workers so that we have the numbers and the strength that Harold referred to that we used to have, so we can influence politics, we can take on companies, and we can win the kind of benefits that workers need.
In 1968, I believe it was, the Teamsters famously endorsed Richard Nixon for president. Do you see that happening again by either the SEIU or the Teamsters?
I think in terms of the presidential, that we were, all of our unions were completely united behind John Kerry. We put incredible resources into it. So I don't see any scenario in which we would endorse a candidate like Richard Nixon. What I think you will find is
another Republican, obviously. We're not going to go back to Nixon.
We've endorsed Republicans, Democrats, independents who support the rights of workers. And especially on a state and local level, you'll often find that there are politicians who support workers' right to organize, who support the kind of thing we're doing. So what we're saying is workers need to leave all their options open. And the idea that we would only support Democrats, the Democratic Party, which, to be frank, is not always pro-union. We have people in the Democratic Party that vote for trade bills that are bad for workers, and we don't feel we should then turn around and support them despite the fact that they voted against us.
Stephen Lerner, once again, Director of the Property Services Division of the Service Employees International Union, one of those that has pulled away from the AFL-CIO. Andy Levin is at the convention this week. He heads up the Voice at Work campaign of the AFL-CIO, which helps workers gain the right to organize. He also is formerly an organizer with the SEIU. Andy Levin, this must be a particularly painful moment for you.
Thanks for having me, Warren. Well, yesterday was a sad day, and I was angry when my own union decided to divide the labor movement over really what are very small differences, but a lot of rhetoric.
Why do you say the differences are small, given what we heard just now from Stephen Lerner and given the decline in the labor movement in terms of its numbers and its effectiveness politically?
Because I and we agree with virtually everything that Stephen has said. There's a major crisis for workers in this country. They've effectively lost the right to organize. They've lost pensions and health insurance, and their wages are stagnant and declining. The income and wage gaps are growing, and it's because we're not organizing fast enough. And we just think we can do it better united than divided. I mean, for example, Stephen talks about the need to do big campaigns, global campaigns that take on these giant corporations. Well, the AFL-CIO designed and implemented with a union called the Graphic Communications Industrial Union, which has just now joined the Teamsters, one of the dissidents, a campaign to take on the second largest printing company in the world, Quebecor. It's based in Canada. Its workers are unionized in Canada. They're unionized in Europe and Brazil and so forth. And yet here they fight workers and refuse to let them organize freely. So we ran a global campaign. We had Quebecor workers from a dozen countries in Mississippi doing house visits. We had the a minister of education from another country telling the company that they would no longer allow them to print their textbooks if they didn't respect the workers' rights to organize in the United States. And we won a neutrality agreement. An agreement that allows these workers to organize freely in the United States. And now, last week in Fernley, Ohio, Fernley, Nevada, the first group organized, and more groups are organizing. So we agree with Stephen. The point is, if you don't get your way exactly, you don't just pick up your marbles and go home. I mean, the behavior of the Change to Win leadership reminds me of the way my sister was when we used to play Monopoly when we were kids. And if I built too many hotels on property and it looked like she was going to lose, she said, game over.
Do you think that this is as much about personality and money as anything else? It's been reported that Andy Stern, now the head of the SEIU, is very ambitious and feels competitive with John Sweeney, even though he came from the same union and was once a mentor to Andy Stern, and that the Teamsters need the money, and they need it to keep their union afloat.
Well, I'm afraid it very much is. It's a power struggle, plain and simple. For example, on the money question, they have asked that one of their big policy proposals was that they get a 50% rebate from the AFL-CIO on the dues they pay if they spend 10% of their budget on organizing. And guess what? That's a threshold that fits the Teamsters exactly. Well, John Sweeney, a decade ago, called on all unions to spend 30% or more of their budget on organizing. And if just two of the unions in their coalition, the Teamsters and the United Food and Commercial Workers, went from the 10% or less of their budget they spend on organizing today to 30%, it would add more new money to organizing than a 50% rebate for the entire membership of all of our unions. So it is about money, and it is about a power struggle. And what we say is, we love new ideas, we love their vision, we certainly need to change as fast as possible. Let's do it together. Let's not divide the labor movement, and we're going to keep reaching out and trying to create unity and not division.
Andy Levin with the AFL-CIO. Back to Stephen Lerner with the SEIU, Service Employees International. What do you say to all of that? The philosophical differences aren't that great. Why not get together or stay together?
You know, it's always funny when somebody you have a disagreement with claims there's really not a disagreement. What it reminds me of is when you're negotiating with an employer and the employer says, well, I agree I should pay you more money, or I agree that there should be a grievance procedure that protects you, but I don't believe I should have to do it. I believe that it's sort of up to me whether I want to do it. And the bottom line is there's core philosophical and different issues. We believe that there should be industry-wide unions that are focused on organizing one industry, that they're not organizing 20 or 30 industries. We believe that there shouldn't be the continued disunity we have now, where you have 15 airline unions competing with each other while wages are driven down. We think the crisis is that you have disunity now, and you don't have a plan, you don't have unions working together, and because everybody puts the same initials after their name doesn't mean we're working together. We think the best thing to do is rebuild the House of Labor by taking the unions that really believe in change and really believing in organizing, and we work together. We want to work with the AFL on a local level. We want to partner where it makes sense. And we actually think it's not that big a deal that we're not working together nationally. The real work is on the grassroots level, and there people will continue to work together, and what happens in Chicago won't be a major matter there.
So you say there are great disagreements, but a split isn't a split.
Well, we're saying that there's a split at the top, that we have basic philosophical differences. We believe they're not changing quickly enough. We believe that they're not willing to force the kind of unity that's needed, the unity of action and unity of planning, not just the unity of rhetoric, but that on the local level, at central labor councils and state feds, that our unions will stay involved, that where there's good work going on, we'll be engaged. We'll also be engaged with all sorts of community and other unions that aren't in the AFL-CIO. We think what's exciting is that there's an opportunity for people to work together where it makes sense, and there's an opportunity for those of us who have a different kind of vision of how to organize to work together where it does make sense.
All right. We're going to take a very brief break, and when we come back, I want to ask you all about a poll done by Zogby International, which shows that just 1 in 3 non-union workers would consider voting to unionize, whereas 56% would not. A poll, albeit done for a conservative organization, nonetheless by Zogby International, well respected firm. I'll ask our current guests about that, talk with other guests as well in just a moment on To the Point. On Reporter's Notebook is the phrase war on terrorism, going out of style in the Bush administration. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warren Olney back with To the Point, talking today about the labor movement in the United States. Nobody denies that it is losing numbers and losing clout. We now have a formal division of the biggest one since the Depression. Between major unions pulling out of the AFL-CIO, and we've just heard what the arguments are, or what some of the arguments are, on both sides. I want to get back to that poll in a moment, which may or may not demonstrate the case that the union movement is in sad straits at this point. First, though, I want to turn to the senior editorial writer at the Wall Street Journal, a paper which had an editorial in today's edition about the split in the AFL-CIO. The Wall Street Journal, of course, not to be expected to be in favor of unions as opposed to management. Kim Strussel is, again, senior editorial writer for the paper, and good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
The editorial in your paper today effectively says that neither side of the labor movement gets it. Explain.
Well, I think the argument that we were trying to make today is that most of the discussion that's going on right now around the convention and the unions pulling out has been about tactics. How do we go about organizing in better ways? What way can we use our money most effectively to have the most clout? How should we court certain politicians in different ways? No one's actually talking about the message that union leaders have been sending to workers and whether or not that's a message that anyone actually responds to and is willing to therefore join a union over. I mean, the number of union workers as a percentage of, you know, the U.S. economy has been on sliding for years and years now. And we seem to not have a union leadership that has stepped back and sort of said, maybe we're failing to connect to people. Maybe we're not offering them a vision. Maybe they don't see a reason to organize, to come and belong to a union. And just to correct you, we don't have anything against unions as so long as they're actually working on behalf of workers.
You are, though, certainly one of the major conservative voices in the country at the moment, usually associated with corporations and Republicans rather than unions and Democrats.
Well, we basically are there for people who believe the most in free markets and free people. So.
Okay. All right. What would you, however you may feel about unions, suggest as a better message to workers than the ones they're getting now?
Well, I think that one thing we're seeing happen is, especially there's a lot of younger workers today, they look around, they realize that we're in a global economy, we're in an information economy, they see tech companies coming along, and they're not willing to necessarily go along with a lot of the things that unions, we're no longer in an industrial age where companies are simply just wreaking profits and trampling down the workers. A lot of workers understand that their own success at a company depends on their company succeeding too. And in that regard, when you look at a lot of the unions who've poured money into Democratic causes and Democrats who have voted for higher taxes, who voted for anti-trade policies, who are voting against private Social Security accounts or for more privatized health care, I think a lot of workers look and say, is this necessarily something that's going to help my company? I mean, it can't possibly help GM to actually be saddled with such huge health care costs that it ends up having to lay off people because those are fewer jobs for people out there. And I think one of the things we were asking was, where is the union leader who comes out and says, you know, we should be for private Social Security accounts so that workers can actually save money for their own benefit and that they will have that at the end of their lives and they don't have to depend on the success or failure of a pension plan or like the airlines. They don't have to sit back and just hope that it doesn't actually go bankrupt in the end and that they won't get anything in the end. Or where are the union leaders who are supporting some sort of competitive health care that allows workers to have portable health care that they can take from job to job? Or where are labor leaders who are supporting more flexible work environments rather than having sort of rigid work rules where seniority rules, it's about rewarding people who work hard? And I think that younger workers in particular look at that and they say, these are not organizations that are fighting for my best interests and I have no reason to join.
Kim Strassel, again, senior editorial writer at the Wall Street Journal. Back to Stephen Lerner, again, with the Service Employees International Union moving away from the AFL-CIO. What are, or do you resonate at all with any of the issues just listed by Kim Strassel?
Well, the only thing I'd agree with her on is that the economy is changing radically and unions haven't adopted, and we need to adopt. And one of the things that we've said is unions have made lots of mistakes in not adopting to those changes. But the solution isn't for us, or none of her solutions are the correct solution. What we've said, for example, is the way you deal with companies competing against each other is you have to organize all of them at the same time so that when workers get raises, it doesn't put their company at a competitive disadvantage because everybody's paying the same wage rate. We've said the way you deal with globalization is we're now working with unions in other countries. that have the same company is to organize them simultaneously in multiple countries. So we believe you have to offer new solutions based on how the economy is reorganized, but those are should be based on how workers win a better life and how we deal with the modern economy. So, for example, we do have portable pension plans. We do have portable health care plans. The struggle is to gain the strength to make sure that companies pay into them and support them. So I think what she's correctly saying is we need to change, but her solutions offer little to the average worker.
Do your solutions, Stephen Lerner, still depend on the industrial model in the sense that it is assumed that workers and management have a fundamental disagreement that can only be worked out through negotiation and bargaining?
Well, our solutions are based on the fact that you have giant corporations whose primary motivation is not to provide jobs, but is to make money, and that you need to equalize and level that playing field. What's interesting, though, is one of the reasons we're being successful is many of the employers we are organizing are what you would call subcontractors or outsourced through in the new economy. So what we've realized we have to do is look at all different ways to help workers become stronger. So we've worked to where there's now $1 trillion of pension capital. And when it invests in an office building, it says, we think it's a better investment if you pay workers decently, the subcontracted workers, because we get better cleaning. So we look at all the different ways you can build worker strength, from pension fund power to how you get political and religious and other kind of support to equalize a playing field. Because actually what's really happening is corporations are becoming stronger, and it makes there even greater need for unions.
Kim Stressel, what about that? The corporations getting stronger, particularly in the current political environment? The SEIU is suggesting this industry-wide organization so that companies aren't competing against one another. You can have portable benefits. Isn't that a way of dealing with the issues you raised?
Well, actually, I mean, there isn't any way. I think it's a laudable idea if you want to try to go out and organize everyone. But, I mean, it's not going to work. You're always going to – the whole idea of a competitive market, which is what we live in today, is that there is always going to be a company, there is always going to be a country with companies in it that are going to be more efficient, have workers who are more capable at doing the jobs they do and doing them well, and that you're going to have competition between those companies. I mean, it's all well and good to make sure that, for instance, General Motors is unionized across all the countries that it operates in, but there are always going to be other car companies that you don't unionize who are going to do it better. The question is, who can do this most competitively? And in that regard, workers have an incentive to be involved with making sure that corporations aren't working in a high-tax environment, aren't over-regulated, aren't actually all these things that drive up costs and make it harder for U.S. companies in particular to compete with in the global arena.
Andy Levin, let me get you back in this conversation again with the AFL-CIO, the Voice at Work campaign. And let me ask you, by way of response to Kim Stressel, what about this Zogby International poll, which shows that just 1 in 3, 35% of non-union workers would consider voting to unionize, while 56% would not? Again, it's the Zogby poll done for a conservative group, but nonetheless with the imprimatur that Zogby has. Why is that the case?
Well, first of all, Warren, if those people unionized, we would have the highest percentage of our workforce unionized in the history of the United States.
With the 35%, if you just got it
added to the percent that we have today.
Okay.
So that's wouldn't be a terrible thing. The problem is that workers are not free to form unions in this country. We think we have better polling than Zogby. As you said, he's polling for a very conservative, basically an outright anti-union organization, an organization whose reason for being is the destruction of unionization of the public sector. Whereas we have done polls every year for years, the Peter Hart organization, that asks workers in a more neutral way if they'd like to be members of unions or not. And our polling says that 53% of non-union workers would like to be in unions. That would amount to 57 million more workers in unions. Not all workers, but a lot of non-union workers would like to be in unions. And the reason is that collective bargaining is the way we built the middle class in this country. It's the way workers got pensions. It's the way workers got health insurance against the wishes of the Wall Street Journal, which oppose, you know, these things all the way. And workers need collective bargaining today.
What do you mean when you say they're not free to form unions?
Well, in the United States today, employers are perfectly free, it's perfectly legal for them to subject workers to mandatory anti-union meetings. They can fire them for not coming to these meetings. They can fire them for coming if they're worried that they'll come and speak up and ruin their perfect anti-union intimidation session. Direct supervisors are free under our law to call you in and say, Warren, they close the door and they say, Warren, I just want you to know, I think this union thing would be really bad for both of us. Do you understand? They're free to campaign against unionization all day, every day on work time, whereas pro-union workers and are not allowed to campaign at all on work time, and union staff can be arrested, and Stephen and I have both been threatened with arrest many times for going on company property. So it's so bad that Human Rights Watch did a year-long investigation and in 2000 declared that the United States is fundamentally out of compliance with international human rights norms in this area. Our National Labor Relations Board fines every year 20,000 workers on average in the last several years have had their rights violated, and they are given some back pay, a little bit of back pay, usually years after their rights were violated. So we have a major campaign to restore the freedom to form unions in this country, and until now, the service employees and the Teamsters have both participated. And we've got federal legislation called the Employee Free Choice Act, which would allow workers to organize freely. And the ironic thing is that somebody like Kim ought to be in favor of a free market for worker representation.
Let me ask her that question, put that to her. Kim Strassel with the Wall Street Journal. What about it?
Oh, I think it'd be great if you could have a free market for this. But I think that what no one else is talking about here is the way that you're compelled to do things if you belong to a union. How many states are there where if you do not want to belong to the union that is in your company, you are forced to, and you are forced to pay your dues whether or not you ever wanted to be part of that organization in the first place. You are also forced to sit by as much of that money goes as the union pours it into often candidates who you don't support in elections. So, I mean, there's a lot that we could discuss here about people's rights and workers' rights in particular, and that isn't entirely the entire story.
All right. Let me go back to our very first guest, Harold Meyerson, who, again, is editor-at-large of the American Prospect. That is, compared to the Wall Street Journal, certainly a liberal publication. He's also a columnist for the Washington Post and political editor and columnist for the LA Weekly. How is all of this playing out politically? To what extent has the labor movement become, as it has been charged, a satellite of the Democratic Party? And if labor vote is up for grabs in the way that Stephen Lerner suggested it might be, with supportive for independents and Republicans at the same time, would that be good or bad for American workers?
Well, the decisive change in American politics took place when the Republican Party shifted from Northeast and Midwest roots and a tradition that was somewhat comfortable with unions to its Sunbelt more conservative aspect over the last 30 years, more or less destroying any tolerance for unions in the Republican Party, except for a relatively small percentage of Midwest and Northeast elected Republicans. So the tilt towards Democrats has kind of been really forced by large changes in the two parties. Both the unions that have left and the remaining unions in the AFL-CIO share a fundamental political orientation. There is a generational difference among some labor leaders as to the degree to which the Democratic Party either rings bells positively or not. The leaders of some younger labor leaders who maybe spent a lot of time organizing in the South are a little more distanced from the label Democrat, just as a reaction to that experience. But on the whole, there's really a pretty consistent commitment to doing politics generally for Democrats because they are the more pro-labor or less anti-labor of the two parties. It cuts across all sides in the current dispute.
All right. Well, let me go back and finish up with our two guests from the different sides of organized labor. And first go to Stephen Lerner with the Service Employees International Union. You said earlier that there is an intent to work at the local level with AFL-CIO unions, presumably not to raid each other's members and that sort of thing. Do you think that there can be ultimately a reorganization and that the AFL-CIO can get back together with the SEIU and the Teamsters ever consider that at least anytime soon?
I think the right question to ask is how do we start to win again? How do we start to succeed? And it may be that if we start growing and we start winning in the way we should and workers start regaining health insurance and pension plans, that we come up with a totally different kind of organization that we should all be part of. I don't think the primary question anymore is a union in the AFL-CIO or not in the AFL-CIO. The question is, what is our vision and who are we working with to try to change this country? And where it makes sense to work with the AFL-CIO, we'll do it. But where it doesn't, we'll partner with other people. And we think we need to start looking for the future, not reflecting on the past, and that there's incredible opportunities out there, and we hope to take advantage of them.
Andy Levin with the AFL-CIO, what do you think is the right question to ask?
Well, I think that I think Stephen's question about the vision for the future is absolutely a correct question to ask. The problem is that we fundamentally agree on it. So you've got a situation where, for example, one of the members of the Change to Win Coalition, which has not seceded from the AFL-CIO, Unite Here, which represents a lot of hotel workers, has won the sort of freedom to organize agreements from 25 hotels in recent years through the actions of the local central labor councils going to cities, counties, when there's convention centers, when they're leasing property, when they're tied to a new hotel that's going to be built, and said, look, if you want to build this hotel, the workers are going to have to be free to organize. And, you know, that works when we all work together, and it doesn't work when we go and divide ourselves. And I hope that we can have everybody come back into the House of Labor and have one united front against the corporate onslaught that is trying to tear down workers' rights and workers' progress in this country.
All right. We will see what happens as the convention continues and, more importantly, as the division continues between the major elements of organized labor. Meantime, thanks to all of you for being with us. Andy Levin, again, with the Voice to Work campaign at the AFL-CIO. Stephen Lerner, director of the Property Services Division at the Service Employees International Union, one of those who has left the AFL-CIO. Kim Strussel, senior editorial writer at the Wall Street Journal, and Harold Meyerson with the American Prospect, The Washington Post, and the LA Weekly. Thanks again to all of you for being with us today. Today's New York Times reports that the Bush administration is, quote, retooling its slogan for the fight against al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups. The Times says that the catchphrase, global war on terror, has lost its usefulness because it focuses only on military solutions. More on that in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
We're in Alney, back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Yesterday at the National Press Club, General Richard Myers, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, told reporters he always objected to the term war on terrorism. He said terror is only the method used by violent extremists who are the real enemy. He said the solution to dealing with the violent extremists is more diplomatic, more economic, more political than it is military. Benjamin Barber teaches political science at the University of Maryland. His books include Jihad versus McWorld and Fear's Empire, War, Terrorism, and Democracy. Professor, welcome to our program.
Hi, Warren.
Does this strike you, as it apparently does the reporters in the New York Times, as a rather subtle but nonetheless significant change on the part of the Bush administration?
Well, I think it's more than that. It's a shameless renunciation of their own strategy for the last several years and an acknowledgement that their critics, who heretofore have been labeled traitors to America, have in fact been right, because there have been many people in Europe and in America arguing that a purely military strategy was counterproductive, was unlikely to do anything to stop terrorism. On the contrary, one needed a much broader group of strategies that included intelligence, economic, public diplomacy, and political political strategies. And as I say, this administration has been systematically calling such people, if not traitors, something pretty near that. So I guess treason has finally found a home in the White House.
Well, you're using a very strong language. The New York Times is saying that this revamped campaign that's apparently not going to feature that phrase so much has grown out of meetings of the president's national security advisors, and it reflects an evolution in Mr. Bush's own thinking. So what do you think might have brought about a change in thinking on his part?
Well, I think the utter failure of the policies that he was following, because, you know, what we've seen is almost 2,000 casualties later in Iraq and 25 to 100,000 civilian casualties later. We see no progress there, but the insurgency is getting stronger and America caught in a kind of quagmire. We see in Afghanistan, which was held up as a model of the military strategy, that things may be unraveling there rather than getting better. And we see, of course, not just in Bali and Riyadh and other places, but in London now, the ongoing consequences of unabated terrorism. So, I mean, I think one has to say this is a kind way of acknowledging failure. And, you know, one wishes once in a while that this White House would actually be a little bit honest. Mr. Bush seems to be like those lovers who never say, you know, remember that old novel about being in love is never saying you're sorry. This is an administration that never says it's sorry, but the fact is its policies have failed, and there are enough realists around the White House to recognize they have failed and that they need to move in a different direction.
We're talking with Professor Benjamin Barber at the University of Maryland. It has been said many times by critics of the war on terror that it didn't make any sense, that it was really a war against a noun and a war against a strategy. Do you think, by his remarks at the National Press Club yesterday, that General Myers seems to be realizing that, and that he has perhaps realized it all along because he said he objected to the term war on terror?
Well, I think that's right. My own view is that the American military, being composed of smart, intelligent, experienced people in the field, have known from the beginning that military solutions would not resolve the issues of terrorism. And, you know, they've said over and over again they weren't really the appropriate bodies to rebuild and engage in nation building in Afghanistan or Iraq, that they couldn't engage in the kinds of background long-term strategies that might interrupt and interdict the growth of terrorism. And I think some of them have even understood that their own firepower and their own attempts to keep the peace in Iraq through civilian casualties and so on actually contribute to the problem. So I think that's right. I think the military are probably recognized for a pretty long time that this is not the ideal way to take on all of the complex issues associated with violence and terrorism in the modern world.
I don't know how far we can go with this, but the Times quotes Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld as having somewhat changed his language and speaking now about instead of a global war on terror, a global struggle against violent extremism. Do you think that, coupled with what we're hearing from General Myers, suggests that there might be a real shift in strategy and that we might see the results of it?
I think there's no question, even the appointment of Condoleezza Rice to Secretary of State and the comment she made a couple months ago when she first went over to France and to Europe suggested a greater interest in diplomacy, a greater openness to collaboration and cooperation with other nations, even the possibility of working through and with the United Nations. And, you know, one can only welcome that realism. As I say, what's a little disheartening to a lot of us who have spent several years trying to make that case is that we were, and I use that word, I know it's a strong word, traitors, but, you know, there are people in the White House who suggested, as Karl Rove did, that we were at best tree huggers who thought that therapy was the only way to deal with terrorism and that they were the tough guys. And it turns out that the tough guy approach has been an utter failure, hasn't targeted the right people, hasn't interdicted the insurgents, and indeed that terrorism continues to grow not only in Iraq and Afghanistan, but also in Western capitals like London. And we, God forbid, that it should also be New York or Los Angeles in the coming months. And that, as I say, I mean, I'm torn because on the one hand, of course, I want to say I welcome this return to realism, this recognition of the complexities of the world we live in. But it's a little disheartening to see an administration that has put down every attempt at making a more complex world and suggesting that it required more complex solutions itself now recognize the approach of its critics when it's done its best to kind of de-Americanize and turn those critics into traitors to the regime.
You used the phrase tough guy approach a moment ago. I wouldn't want to suggest, and I don't think you want to suggest, that the administration will be any less tough on terrorists per se. It's a change of a different sort that we're talking about here, is it not?
Of course it is, and there's only one way to deal with terrorists, which is to find them, prosecute them, if necessary, kill them. I mean, there's no question about that. The question is whether you do that through the deployment of hundreds of thousands of troops, B-1 bombers, tanks, or whether you do that through careful international intelligence and police cooperation, measured specific strikes at terrorist camps, and a broad background effort to create a world in which terrorists don't have the kind of general support they have now. In one sense, the problem has never been terrorism. There's only a handful of terrorists, and they can't do much damage by themselves. The problem has been a world in which millions, maybe hundreds of millions, who themselves would never be terrorists, feel somewhat sympathetic to the terrorist response because they feel marginalized, voiceless, and angry at the West. As we address their grievances, as we address their problems, we begin to take away the swamp in which the mosquitoes of terrorism breed. And that is a powerful and important part of the campaign that has been largely missing from this administration's work. And to the extent it now acknowledges it, yes, of course, I'm using tough guy in that sense of this the pretended tough guy of the Lone Ranger going out and taking on the bad guys by themselves, and that's not how it's done. It's done through cooperation. It's done through military and police intelligence. It's done through international prosecution. It's done through the International Criminal Tribunal, which we have yet to recognize. It's done in ways that up until now this administration has turned its back on, and one only hopes that in abandoning this phony kind of so-called tough guy policy for a much more tough realism, which recognizes how deep and complex and pervasive the problems that create terrorism are, one hopes that one might actually begin to make some progress in undermining it.
Benjamin Barber, professor of political science, University of Maryland, Jihad versus McWorld, Fears, Empire. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Warren.
Today's program produced by Christian Bordahl with Karen Radziner and Katie Cooper. I'm Warren Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.